Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. Thank you again for being there every week to talk to me, sometimes just me. That's the last Wednesday of the month. The other days, almost always with someone else. And today, I just want to check in with her. Bonnie Burstow, are you there?
I sure am, yes.
Oh, good. You sound really great, Bonnie. Well, let me finish my intro. I didn't get a chance to do my alert today that Bonnie was going to be on, but I may do an alert after the show and let people know. I'll talk a little bit more about Bonnie in a couple of minutes, but I'm just really glad to be here with all of you. And to those of you tuning in, this is PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network, and this is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. And if you want to find out more about me, I've been pioneering criticism of psychiatric drugs and electroshock for 50 or 60 years. I kind of lost track and written many books on the subject. And I've also written about how to live life better, like my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, which I put my whole heart and soul into. If you want to know how I think life can be lived, how to overcome guilt, shame, and anxiety, how to live by reason and love, have a look at Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. You can get it at the usual online. You can get it on my website, Breggin.com, Breggin.com. I've given my website a new face. Those of you who are familiar, and I'd love you to give me some feedback, and you can do that through the dedicated email for this show, which is BregginLive, BregginLive@Hotmail.com. You can write me and ask me questions, and sometimes I will answer on air, and sometimes I will send an answer. In general, though, I can't respond to people asking for help. The best I can do is refer you to empathictherapy.org and to the Resource Center for Therapy there. I just don't have a giant list of folks from around the country. And I limit my practice to the Ithaca area for many different reasons. Now, the show, we are live now on May 8th, 2019, and we take callers. Be glad to hear you call in. I like to orient the callers as much as possible about the show. And then at the end of the month, we open lines to talk about just about anything. And I see we already have a wonderful caller from Canada who probably will address Bonnie directly. Don't forget the daily breaking news. We have a lot of good stuff, a lot of inspirational stuff on how to live more joyfully, and a lot of the latest stuff about the hazards of psychiatric drugs. By the way, and to call in again is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. We've gotten a warning sent to us docs here from Janssen, a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson, who is infamous. I mean, these people have been fined billions by the federal government. And I've had a look at a lot of their inside documentation. And, you know, this is a company that is beleaguered with lawsuits about its various activities. And now they've come out with Spravato, S-P-R-A-V-A-T-O, which is ketamine. It's, a very heavy-duty sedative. and mostly used illegally. And it's been approved now by the FDA. You have to be taking an antidepressant along with it. You have to have direct medical supervision. A healthcare provider should monitor you for at least 2 hours post. And I had a chance to glance at the studies for this really dangerous sedative drug, which will work by disabling your brain, just like all the other psychiatric interventions, from Ritalin for children to shock treatment, which I think Bonnie will be talking about today, among other things. And the studies lasted 4 weeks. Boy, that's a lot. That's a long time, isn't it, to test a drug 4 weeks. By then, what do we know about it? Practically nothing. And it's really interesting because in this case, it looks like the statistically significant changes, differences from placebo occurred after 24 hours, and at 24 hours, and that's about it. And then the placebo patients improved, and the drug group improved. I mean, this is a ridiculous way to approve a drug, and it shows the FDA is not on your side, my wonderful audience. They are not on your side. The drug companies aren't on your side. Approach all this stuff about psychiatry and drugs and medication and the latest thing with all the skepticism in the world. It's just such an important thing. I want to thank those of you who do write in at breganlive@hotmail.com. And Anne wrote me that she's become a vegan recently, and she's thinking clearer, feeling mentally better, and her arthritis improved. And she wondered if the gut was really the kind of the channel to the brain. The gut is perhaps the channel to overall good health. Not perhaps, it is one of the channels to overall good health. Food, the ton of food or more we eat a year goes into that gut of ours and determines our general health. Don't expect improving your diet to just end all of the human struggles we have in life. But an improved diet will improve your health, and that means it will improve your brain function. If you're eating a lot of junk or a lot of meat or a lot of dairy, a lot of processed food, if you're not moving toward a plant-based diet, you're probably not, and exercising some, moderately exercising, you're probably not going to be in the best of health that you can be. And when your overall physical health improves, your mental health will improve. It's one of the organs of your body, and it's going to get better as you physically get better. But it won't necessarily change those obsessions you're struggling with or those painful feelings. It may help a lot or it may not. But food, eating better is definitely one of the things I encourage. And I, when I'm helping people, I bring up eating a vegetable, a plant-based diet. Doesn't mean you have to be a vegan. You don't have to be a vegetarian even. But the more you're plant-based, the healthier you're going to be. I'll be interested to, I don't remember talking to Bonnie about that. So let me go to Bonnie Burstow now. Bonnie, we've known each other for decades. Bonnie is one of the more amazing people on the face of the earth. I mean, she's a poet. She's an artist of all kinds, written nonfiction. She writes amazingly in-depth psychiatric critiques. And I want her, when I turn the mic over to her, to mention what she would be in particular interested in having people read of hers. Bonnie is at the University of Toronto, and she teaches there, and she has set up something I support, which is an anti-psychiatry scholarship for advanced study, and I can let her explain that to you in more depth. She's been on the show before, and so there's a little bit about that, but I'd like to kind of hear her talk about that scholarship fund, which she most amazingly got through the university. Bonnie is just an amazing person, and it's just a pleasure to have you on, Bonnie. How are you doing?
Not bad, thanks. geared up for action.
We gear up when we talk to each other. Bonnie, would you do me a favor and just talk a little bit about the scholarship fund and your name at the University of Toronto, some of the attacks it's been under, how it's doing, and also what do you recommend people read as an introduction to your work of your several books?
Okay. Actually, I'm up to 8 books. And if you only could read one, I would say read Psychiatry and the Business of Madness. It's what I think of as my magnum opus. If you want to read one fiction, read The Other Mrs. Smith, which is a fiction about a very non-fictional thing called electroshock.
And I have read both of those, and I would recommend those to folks very definitely. The novel's very interesting and gives you a whole new way of looking at what happens to somebody who's been through that brain injury. And her book is encyclopedic and detailed and thoughtful and philosophic as well as scientific. So it's one of the really important books in our end of the world. How is the scholarship fund going?
Okay, well, you know, the scholarship I created, and it was the first of, I've now created 5 scholarships. It was the very first one I created, and one where, of course, I anticipated resistance, and I got resistance, not mainly from University of Toronto, but from professionals all around the world, with people demanding I be fired, etc., as the scholarship materialized. But what I did was I put up $50,000 for the scholarship. A anonymous donor matched that $50,000, so we had $100,000. It takes $50,000 to endow a perpetual scholarship. That's something that will exist for time in memoriam. And that happened. We have now twice awarded the scholarship. So every year we get a chance to award it. And an area that, and we're watching the area grow, as there's actually money there for students doing theses, and mostly their doctoral theses, in the area of antipsychiatry. So it's very exciting, and it helps spur a whole new kind of discourse at the university.
Who do you have for readers for these kinds of dissertations?
Well, readers are very complicated. if there's an anti-psychiatry thesis going on at U of T at OISE, I'm likely to be the supervisor. Then there has to be 2 other people on the committee.
And there's a lot of good people around the world who could do that, right?
There are, but there has to be 2 people, more people from U of T. At the end of the day, there has to be an outside examiner. And that outside examiner can't be from U of T. So it's a complicated process, and a doctoral thesis takes about 7 years. But you research people very carefully before you invite them to consider being the external examiner.
Yeah. Wow. Well,
but this
what
this,
an accomplishment. Bonnie, what an accomplishment.
Yeah. What this does at U of T at OISE is announce to the world that anti-psychiatry is a very legitimate form of inquiry and maybe even a necessary form of inquiry. And it spurs on more and more scholars to say, hey, maybe I can do work in this area. Maybe I can write a thesis in this area. That's very exciting.
Yes, it is. So congratulations again on this I signed on very early to lending my name to this, and I'm really proud to have done it.
I remember very well, and I remember everyone I asked to sign on were very nervous, like they were saying, they were thinking somewhat inwardly, this doesn't have a hope of going through. But, you know, I've now, that's been true of most scholarships I've endowed, and I've always won eventually. You get good at figuring out how to navigate the system, right?
Yeah, I suspect I didn't have much hope for it going through, Bonnie.
Huh?
I don't think I had much hope for it going through.
Oh, I know you didn't, and I know that Ginger didn't. So I remember you guys talking about it, saying that the drug, you know, their companies would stop it. And what I knew is I would keep plugging the value of academic freedom again and again and again until we won. And that's what won, the concept that you shouldn't be blocking academic freedom.
Well, congratulations. Congratulations. What should we focus on today? We talked about you coming on the air a few weeks ago, and we didn't chat today. But I'd like to focus it on whatever right now you think is of interest to our audience and also to you. And I'd also be by the half hour or so, take one or two callers that we have so far.
I'd like to focus in, you know, your callers and people who listen to your show will know that there was an important court case about electroshock in the States, in which the judge's determination is that a reasonable jury could find that the shock machine manufacturers caused brain damage. And that's kind of, to some degree, slowly started changing the landscape. What we are now trying to mobilize with that somewhat changed landscape, and so we are we're having a press conference on Friday of this week, then Saturday we're having a rally against electroshock, and then the following day we're beginning a hunger strike against electroshock.
So oh my, what day is that that you're beginning the hunger strike?
We're beginning the hunger strike on Sunday, May the 12th, and the leading hunger striker will be an 18-year-old, an 80-year-old woman electroshock survivor.
Oh, my God, Bonnie.
We've got a symbol there. So far, the media hasn't bit, but I'll be damned if I know why, because this is almost, you know, this is the kind of image Gandhi would have prayed for, you know, in terms of something that says people pay attention. Well, we'll wait to see. Maybe people will. But Connie Neal, who's the principal hunger striker, you know, she was shocked back in the 60s. She'd been fighting shock since the early 80s, maybe even the 70s. I've been fighting it since the early 80s. And once you get to a certain age, you want to see it ended now. You don't want to wait. You certainly won't trust what a future generation will do if we haven't taken care of this.
Now, Connie Neal has called in, and
terrific.
We can just have her join in now, or we can have you talk for a little while longer, whatever you prefer. I'd kind of like to hear a little more from you and then have Connie join the show.
Sure, that sounds great.
And Steve Tickton, psychiatrist, a man I spent a lot of time with a few decades ago in Great Britain, who's in Canada, has called in and will take his call. These are going to be very interesting discussions.
So both Connie and Stephen are people involved in this action.
Great. Good. Well, let's go ahead and may I comment for a minute about the lawsuit?
Please do, yes.
This was a lawsuit against a shock company for the manufacture of that manufactures Thymatrons, one of two in North America, and previously, a lawsuit had been rejected against another company on the grounds that there wasn't sufficient evidence, the judge said, to connect the shock machines to brain injury. And this time they called me in, and I wrote the statement under oath for the judge, documenting all of the data we have for brain damage from the machine. So I'm really proud to have been involved in that, and that was largely the basis of the judge's determination that there was, in fact, enough scientific information to present it to a jury as a part of a malpractice or a negligence suit. I'm not exactly how that was phrased, against Somatics Inc., the manufacturer of Thymatron. And then they settled as soon as the judge said that, almost within a breath, an inhale. And then very quickly they posted a statement that they had informed the FDA of a new warning they were going to put onto the machine, that it could cause, well, that it did in some cases cause brain damage and extensive memory loss. And this is really new. Now they keep waffling, and they waffled then. And then the FDA rescued them, just literally within weeks, rescued them, attempted to at least, by saying they were now going to approve. This is pretty much out of the blue. The machines for treatment-resistant depression. And I don't know what's happened since then. I cannot follow everything under the sun, and maybe nothing has happened. Can you, or maybe Connie or Steve will be able to fill in more on that process that's been going on?
That's as far as I've gotten to, with Somatics putting up a warning on their website saying that the machine can cause permanent brain damage. That's the last I heard of any development on this.
Yeah, man, me too. Me too. This is all a big deal, folks, because, you know, there were early years, decades ago, where, you know, all judges had to say to me were nasty things that I dared imply that psychiatry was damaging people's brains with shock treatment. And now we have a judge specifically confirming it, and now we have the machine manufacturer doing it. You know, it's so interesting to watch my own lifespan from decades ago being literally insulted by judges around, how do I dare be the lone voice with nobody in agreement with me, and denying all this, refusing to even review all the scientific papers or the entire scientific book I'd written on the subject, and, you know, these disasters. And then finally getting to this point now. And we've also had a malpractice victory where I was the expert. We've had one against a doctor who referred a patient for ECT. And I've had a lot of settlements, Bonnie, you know, that, when they didn't want to go to court.
That's a good thing and a horrible thing, isn't it? I mean, the good thing is that people are getting settlements, so there's some kind of remuneration for the terrible damage they have. But the bad thing about the settlements is we don't have something on the record saying these people are found guilty if they're settled out of court.
Exactly. And
that's why they're so eager to settle out of court the second it looks like they're going to lose.
Yeah, I just had a settlement in which I was required to return all the documents I'd received from the drug company. I'm sorry, the ECT manufacturer.
Right.
So, I mean, I have to obey the policies of the law. We live in a nation of laws, more or less, and a lot less lately. And I do adhere to the, you know, the requirements of the courts, and so I had to return a bunch of stuff.
Yeah,
and that's the tragedy of these settlements. I don't have any control over what gets settled or doesn't. Actually, my opinion is almost never asked by the lawyers in these suits about whether they should or shouldn't make a settlement. That's usually plaintiff and the lawyers.
Yeah. I would love to see a case where people didn't take a settlement. And so we actually had something on the record of people being found guilty. And if we got that, we could go to the next stage, maybe, of charging the government with not living up to their fiduciary responsibility and not getting rid of these machines, given the proof and given the court cases.
Yeah, it's a pretty hard thing to do in the U.S. I think there's a chance with these two companies that eventually they'll be stopped by malpractice suits. I think that's a real possibility.
Well, the buck goes a long ways. If they cannot afford what they keep getting sued for, then that could take them out of business eventually.
Yes, that's a possibility. Not in my lifetime necessarily, but I think it's a strong possibility. Well, Bonnie, this is very exciting. Why don't I bring Connie Neal on right now? Let me give my staff there, the staff of PRN, Alex, a chance to take her. Are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Well, come join the show. Would you introduce yourself, and Bonnie can help introduce you?
Well, my name is Connie Neal, and yes, it was in the early 60s that I first received shock treatment. It was after the birth of a baby. And it just so happened that my mother-in-law, who wanted the baby but not me, was a registered nurse and knew a psychiatrist, so there was no question of medication or trying talk therapy or anything. It was straight to the shock room. And that was my very first experience with it, and it was devastating because when I woke up from having this done, I didn't know anything about the fact that I had a baby. I didn't even know who was that man, who was my husband, talking there. And I was, over the next week, I was carried home. Over the next week, I gradually tried to fit myself into the family again. And then I was told it was time for my next shock treatment. And that was when I just flatly refused. And I suppose it was, and that was when I was committed to an Ontario hospital and given 21 more shock treatments. There wasn't even any attempt to medicate me until I was in the Ontario hospital, until I was being given the shock treatment at the same time.
What a horror and what a tragedy. And what happened with your baby, unless it's too painful to talk about?
Well, as a matter of fact, it is something that is really saddens me today because
of course.
This daughter has totally rejected me, and I have to admit that after shock treatment, I was really not much of a mother. And I raised her entirely because that husband was very quickly divorced. And I can only really assume, she said that I was too critical. That's the only comment that she made. So that's all really that I know. And just at a certain point, after she married, I think that she felt a little safety there. That was really the time that she started distancing herself from me. So it is really a great sadness that is left over from the result of the shock treatment, never mind the difficulty with the brain damage, and that is considerable. I now can see a slight difference. I am now 80, and especially when I have some other sickness, my memory really takes a hit, and I would say that at this point, what is happening is a little bit of the old age difficulty with words and so on. And I can tell the difference between the major memory difficulties that I had, especially in learning something, with this present condition, which is the more natural slowing down.
You know, the abuse of women is such a huge issue with shock treatment. If you go to my website, folks, to my resource center on ECT, you can actually bypass the website and go directly just to 123ECT.com. Tried to make it so easy. Everything on it is free, 123ECT.com. And just enter into the search women. And a lot of studies are going to show up, and they're some of the best descriptions of the horror of ECT because they're done by thoughtful, empathic women talking with women who have been through the process. And there are no thoughtful, empathic people doing shock treatment and none within the establishment studying it. Because I don't believe you can be a thoughtful, empathic human being and do shock treatment and just or stand around and just study it without stopping it or trying to stop it. So you'll see an awful lot in there. And Connie is an example. Bonnie, you want to pick up on that thought?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of, for one thing, women are very articulate about what the emotional cost was and what happened to them, but there's another story here. Women get shocked 2 to 3 times as often as men. Women are specifically targeted for shock, and that's been true throughout the entire history of electroshock. And there's one other horror here, and that's women are more damaged by the shock than men are. Everyone's badly damaged, but women are more badly damaged. And in fact, we found that, you know, Connie was one of the people who testified at one of the very early, and was one of the organizers along with me, one of the very early hearings that we gave into shock. And you could hear women after woman talk about losing so much of their memory that you could tell there was a difference between the women's testimony and the men because they lost ever so much more memory. And then after decades of this, in 2007 came the Sackheim study that showed to a point of statistical significance that women's memories are more impaired by electroshock than men. So we're singling out the people most damaged for it to do it mostly too. That's a horrific story.
And then, of course, elderly women, when we've been able to get data, elderly women are particularly at risk and will, of course, have even more damage to their elderly brain. I mean, I'm elderly by any standard, and a blow on the head right now would injure me a lot more than it would have when I was running with a football at the age of 18 or 17. So,
absolutely.
Could I say something?
Please.
Well, there was a lawsuit when my mother died. I am now elderly. And because of my upset, you know, fighting with my brother, I was talking with a counselor who very quickly shifted me over to the chief psychiatrist in this area, who very quickly told me how they had a new, gentle kind of treatment for people like me. I was angry. And I did not know that we had failed in protecting the vulnerable people. And so what I did in that case was I just sat there and continued to say, as he offered me this way of doing it and this way and why we are doing it, I just continued to say no. And I managed to escape that way. And it was right after that that I reconnected with Bonnie and Don White and that group at Kappa and decided that really this needed to still be fought against.
We have a couple of old friends of mine, people I've known for a while. I mentioned Steve Tickton and now Don Weitz, both from Canada. I imagine Don is involved in this project over the weekend. Let's put on Steve. He called first. And Steve, can you join us? This is caller number two.
How are you doing?
Hi, Steve. Steve is a psychiatrist and a stalwart of the reform movement in psychiatry. And I didn't know you were calling. I'm glad to hear from you. Say hello. And then we'll have, in a couple of minutes, we'll get Don Weitz on as well. But Steve, hi. What do you got to say about all this?
Hi, Peter. It's good to hear your voice.
Good to hear yours, too.
Yeah. I have fond memories of meeting you 25 years ago in London and meeting you out at Gatwick airports and traveling together across the country while you bravely gave talks to the media. That was when you published your book, Toxic Psychiatry.
Yeah, I think I was going to start talking about the trip more. I shouldn't do that. Steve, you're involved in this coming weekend on the ECT protest?
Yeah, we're having really a landmark event this weekend.
How do people get involved? If they want to go, if they want to participate, what do? Where do they go? When do they start?
They need to get in touch with Bonnie. That's how they start.
Bonnie, is that true? I know that you have
pretty well true, but they could also just turn up to Queen's Park. They turn up at Queen's Park on Saturday at noon. Queen's Park is our legislative building. They can join in the demo.
Queen's Park, Saturday at noon.
Yes.
And that's in Toronto.
That's in Toronto, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And Bonnie, I want to protect you from giving out your phone number, or do you want to, or your email?
You can certainly write me. You can phone me, too, if you have. But you'll probably get through better by writing me. It's Bonnie, Bonnie, .Burstow, Burstow, at utoronto.ca.
Okay, say it one more time.
Bonnie.Burstow at utoronto, that stands for University of Toronto, .ca. CA stands
for
Canada.
Thank you. And Steve, how did you get involved in this, and are you planning anything special? Are you going to address the group?
Yes, I am, Peter. I'm going to be one of the speakers at the demonstration, along with Don Weitz and a very lovely woman who's involved in Bonnie's organization. Her name is Oriel Varga. And she and I will be kind of organizing the day, actually, at the Queen's Park location. I got involved just by accident. I went to a day conference a couple of years ago that Bonnie gave at the Adler Society. And I'm actually here with one of my friends who I met at that conference. And his name is Alex. He's a philosophy professor up at York University. And he brought another friend along with him by the name of Laval, who is a social worker. I think the only point I really wanted to make actually goes back to the origins of electroshock therapy in fascist Italy in the late 30s. and how it was introduced into psychiatry on a totally fallacious idea that you could not have epilepsy and schizophrenia coexist in the same person. So if you wanted to drive out the schizophrenia, you would induce through electricity an epileptic convulsion. And the interesting thing is that the Italian psychiatrist, Dr. Cerletti, who brought electroshock therapy into psychiatry, he actually wrote in his book that he was very uncertain about this treatment, and he hoped it would eventually be phased out.
His exact words were, "This should be abolished."
Yeah.
This should be abolished.
Abolished.
The inventor.
And the first person he actually tried electroshock therapy on was an itinerant immigrant Italian. And the first attempt at electroshock failed, and Cerletti was really in doubt whether he wanted to actually try it again. But he decided to go back into the room where the patient was, and when he said he was going to give another electroshock, the immigrant shouted out, "No, no, no segunda, not a second time."
Yeah, he actually also added to it, murder, murder.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
Oh, my God. To help people understand a little bit, where doctors would get these kind of weird ideas is that anything that damages the brain makes people more docile. They may get a little out of control for a bit, but repeated injuries to the brain makes people docile. And so they may have seen patients on the wards who were difficult to manage, and then they had a seizure from some other cause than treatment, and they would wake up docile and confused and be easy to manage. I had a dear friend of mine who was kind of a smart aleck in high school. He really was a smart aleck. And he had a seizure in front of my eyes. And when he awoke, he was just so grateful that I was there. He was confused, wanted me to call his mother, but it took him several minutes to even get to that state, and there was just nothing smart-alecky about him after a seizure.
No. You know, my sister recently has had two courses of electroshock therapy, and it has turned her, it has absolutely altered her personality. She was always a very colorful, boisterous, socially outgoing person, and now she is exactly as you describe, docile and manageable. So, Peter, would it be fair to say that electroshock therapy produces a frontal lobe syndrome?
Oh, it is absolutely an electrically induced lobotomy.
Yeah.
And that is a frontal lobe syndrome. There's no question about it. The person wakes up. Well, first of all, the person's put into a coma. People don't realize this. The shock to the brain causes a coma. So you're getting repeated comas. You wake up with what could be called a severe concussive disorder or acute traumatic brain injury. Pretty much the same words. Person is disoriented when they wake up. They're confused. They have no memory for what's recently occurred. They are a helpless feeling. They're a shambles. And if you had one blow like this and that kind of recovery as a professional athlete, you'd be off the field until you recovered.
Yeah.
And that might be weeks.
Right.
Whereas in shock, they just, "Oh, that was great. We'll give you two a week or three a week." That's how bizarre it is, folks. It is so bizarre.
Yeah.
Let me get Don Weitz on the air, too.
Idea.
Caller six. Don Weitz. We all know each other.
Hello?
Hi, Don.
Hi, I finally got on. I've been trying for the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay. Oh, I didn't see your... You know
listen,
what?
First, I want to congratulate you and Bonnie.
Don, I have
Connie
not been overlooking you.
Up.
I don't know how that happened. I would never overlook you. But anyway, hi, Don, tell people who you are. And
well, first, hello?
Yes,
hello?
We're here.
I'm a survivor of 110 insulin shock treatments. I was lucky to escape electroshock in 1952 in Boston. But I want to say, I want to congratulate you, Bonnie Burstow, and Connie Neal for being very, very courageous and speaking out about the horrible brain damage and permanent memory loss that electroshock always causes. And there'll be many more with women speaking out on May 11th at Queen's Park in Toronto. And by the way, there's another protest by women in Montreal on the same day, in Montreal in Canada. So there are...
Did we lose Don?
There are three. There is also an anti-shock protest in Trafalgar Square in England on the same day.
Okay, I was focused on Canada.
On Canada.
Where is the one, so our audience can hear, where is the one in Montreal? And what time is it?
Well, it's in Montreal. I don't know exactly where.
Okay.
Sorry. But it's Pare Shock, P-A-R-E hyphen C-H-O-C is the name of the organization. But I also want to say that I'm very, very angry toward the Canadian Psychiatric Association and American Psychiatric Association for continuing to lie about how safe and effective shock is while they damage brains. And by the way, the Toronto media are involved in covering up the real horror of electroshock. So I just want to be on record of saying that I greatly admire the courage and strength of Connie Neal and Bonnie Burstow and others who are speaking out. And I will definitely be there on Saturday. And I hope many media for a change will show up at the protest.
Don, it's fun to think about how long you and I have worked together.
That's right.
Not, you know, we stay in communication, but we used to be much more active together. And I'm thinking it's 30 or more years ago when I got stuck in the Toronto airport. And I called you on the phone. All the hotels were filled. I was either going to sleep in the airport or find a friend. I called you. And I ended up taking a cab to your apartment, stayed overnight with you. Do you remember that?
I remember, and there's still a couch here. So if you're ever here, you're welcome. Listen, Peter.
Yes.
I really feel very strongly about this. It's been 75 years since the introduction of shock in Canada and the United States. And I blame the psychiatrists and the neurologists, mainly, with the exception of one or two who have remained silent, and they are complicit. Most of the psychiatrists are telling lies about shock, and I'm glad the women are speaking out, and I respect the hunger strike of Connie Neal and supporters to make sure that the media and the public know how serious a crime against humanity is going on in the name of so-called mental health.
Well, I'm in total agreement with you. My colleagues in psychiatry have been so bad about this.
Yes.
There's hardly any. I mean, there's a, you know, it's just terrible.
You know why they don't speak out?
Yep. You know, between me and Steve Tichton, we sort of own the market on consistently over the years speaking out, unquestionably condemning shock treatment. I'm sure there's one or two others, but that's pretty much. And that's sad. It's fear. The doctors who do shock are—they're inflicting violence on people. So they're a rather violent lot,
that's right,
whatever they
violence.
Way they can be. And they suppress
it's
other docs.
Violence against women, as Bonnie Bristow has pointed out many years ago.
Yeah.
Violence against women has got to stop. But the media aren't framing the issue like that, Peter.
No,
they
of course not.
They aren't complicit in misinforming and frankly lying about the real horror, especially women who have suffered much more than men.
Well, I think that's true.
Yes,
it's true across
it
psychiatry, but it appears to be in some ways especially true about shock treatment, because you know every few years some big TV show in the U.S. does something positive on shock treatment. Golly, and it just goes on and on like that. But what a group this is to get together. Go ahead.
We're an old lot here. All of us have been fighting these things for decades and decades and decades. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's great to be together, but it would be even nicer not to have to get together because we want to celebrate the shock's an end rather than getting together to once again rail against shock.
I think, Bonnie, and all of us, I think that shock is so evil that the average person just can't wrap their minds around it. I see much greater change in relation to the drugging, say, of children and all the drugging of women and older women that's going on now. But shock treatment just keeps chugging along. And I think it's like too deep and evil for people to deal with. I don't know what your thoughts are on this, Bonnie, or anyone in this wonderful group.
Go ahead, Don. You want to say something?
1,000 plus, there are probably more than 15,000 people that are getting shocked in Canada, and that means over 10,000 to 12,000 of them are women. Shock should be banned. It's a crime against humanity. And the media is not framing it. Shock should be abolished, just as Bonnie said. And the media has to be held account, not to mention the national and international associations of psychiatry who are complicit. It's got to be banned. There's no legal or ethical or medical justification for the continuation of psychiatry and state-sponsored brain damage of women and children and everybody else. Thank you.
I want to go to something that Peter said, because we know that the drug companies can, to a large extent, control the media. What we don't know is so can the electroshock companies, and I think that's one of the things going on. Mm. I've seen reporters start to cover a shock story and then suddenly disappear, where they're not covering it anymore. I had one major reporter in a major Toronto paper several years ago who approached me, who was talking to me on a daily basis, who I was sharing research with, who was all excited, and then wouldn't respond to a single email after all of this. And I have to ask, how did that person get shut up? What is the power of the shock industry here?
I think it's more the power of psychiatry, because any department chair, any professor of psychiatry, either openly or tacitly support shock treatments. They don't even have to go to the companies. They just call their stable of psychiatrists, and they'll be told that it's an outright lie, that in suicidal cases it's the last resort when there's more evidence it causes suicide than prevents it. There's zero evidence that it prevents it.
Yes, zero.
So I think it's psychiatry as a whole defending itself.
Psychiatry as a whole is a major...
The psychiatrists are on the take from Big Pharma.
But none of that explains the media, and I've raised the issue of the media.
I think it's the pharmaceutical industry and psychiatry in general.
100% silence.
Yeah, absolutely. We've only got 2 or 3 minutes left. I'm going to apologize to my last caller.
Bring your last caller on.
All right, Julie, come on. You've been invited on by Bonnie. Is Julie still there?
You have so many people I admire in the same hour. Oh, my goodness.
It's amazing. This was not
your newsletter.
I didn't know we'd have such an amazing moment in time.
It is. It really is, my goodness. I am a shock survivor. If anybody's wondering, I have a document that I put up on my blog. It's available for anybody to read. This is the document that I sent to the FDA. Funny, I wrote it in 3 days because I was in the process of moving, a big move, and I just didn't have much time, but I wrote it very, very quickly, and it's 28 pages long. Relax, it's double-spaced. I send it to them, and they put it up there in full, and that I know of did not do anything. I mean, they ignored it because it didn't quote studies. It's just a personal story of two things that happened to me. I focus mostly on what happened afterwards, because that's when the worst cover-up was. And I think people who know me know my story, basically, but I couldn't figure out. I kept asking, what's wrong with my brain? What's wrong with my brain? And they finally said, well, you have a personality disorder. But, oh, that just developed, huh? I wasn't getting any better. And so they tried to convince me that I've been that way all my life, been spacey all my life. And I actually believe them. I mean, I was spacey, so I believe them. And I didn't realize it wasn't true. And it took me about 10 years to figure out, more than 10 years, about 15 years, to figure out that they had completely lied to me. Of course, I knew I never had a personality disorder. And I knew, but it took me that long to figure out that what...
I have to finish up now. Thank you, all of you, for being on the phone today. Especially my rock over the ages of intellectual acuity and great work, Bonnie Burstow. Thank you for being on, all of you. And Queen's Park, Saturday at noon in Toronto. Thanks, all of you.